Chicago could become the biggest American city to try out universal basic income by giving $500 a month to 1,000 families with no strings attached. Here's Alderman Amaya Pawar.
What this will do is make sure that a family who has a tough time paying for child care or putting diapers on their infant or buying that last week of groceries, that they will be able to do that. And I think there is a case to be made for direct cash.
Plus, more companies are using artificial intelligence to try to hire the best candidate. Why is this happening, and is it a good idea?
It's more reacting to an incredible talent shortage that's going on, you know, nationwide and beyond. Companies are struggling to fill a number of positions from hourly to the executive suite.
That's all coming up on this special Labor Day edition of the 21st. Stay with us. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you're having a great Labor Day weekend, whether you're at home, on the road, or maybe enjoying one last cookout. Today, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations about work. Later in the hour, we'll dive into how more companies are using artificial intelligence to recruit for jobs and whether or not that's a good thing. We'll also hear from a Northwestern physicist about the work she does to learn about the ins and outs of black holes. But first, have you heard of universal basic income? It's an idea where every citizen receives an amount of money on a regular basis with no strings attached. The idea has gotten more traction in recent years and has even been tried out in a couple of American cities. Alaska actually has a version of this called the Alaska Permanent Fund. Here in Illinois, one Chicago alderman is pushing for a pilot program to see whether this would work in our state's largest city. Amaya Pawar is the alderman putting forth this proposal. He's a Democrat who represents Chicago's 47th ward on the city's north side. I spoke with him earlier this year, and I started by asking him what economic problems he thought universal basic income could help solve.
Income inequality grows every day. 70% of Americans cannot shoulder a $1,000 emergency. One in three parents can't afford to put diapers on their children. 50% of adults will experience poverty in their lifetimes, and many people who live in poverty work full-time, and they simply don't earn enough to get ahead. So there's that, the reality of widening income inequality, and then you have the coming threat of automation, where lots of jobs in a variety of sectors, from blue-collar to white-collar positions, will be automated in the near future. It's not science fiction. So we have to start thinking about, well, what does the future of work look like? How do we help those living in poverty today? And what might a solution look like that targets both of those issues? And universal basic income does that.
Why not say raising the minimum wage? You talked about the fact that most people who are working, who were in poverty are working. Why not look at raising wages more?
In fact, I've worked on that. I worked to raise a minimum wage at $13 an hour. I support a $15 an hour minimum wage. I worked on paid sick leave. I'm working on with a coalition on fair scheduling. But the thing is, a lot of these jobs are also, McDonald's recently announced that they will replace many of their workers with iPad-type stations to order. So a lot of these jobs will be automated. So the question is, what are we doing about the future while helping people today who are working full time in a lot of these jobs that may be automated live in a dignified manner?
And who do you think this would help the most? Are you thinking this would be targeted towards working families? What's the idea of who would be able to get this money?
So what we're looking to do is work with the mayor's office to empanel a task force to start thinking about what a pilot cohort could look like. And obviously, the at least my focus would be on working families, those families that are struggling to put food on the table to make ends meet. That would be my focus. Obviously, if you're thinking about it from a universal standpoint, there is no means test. But I believe that we have to start somewhere. And I think there is an opportunity in Chicago with the mayor's leadership and partnership to help a cohort of struggling families. And again, prove that when you help poor people with making ends meet or putting food on the table, that if you provide them with direct cash, that they don't make bad decisions. That narrative of deserving and undeserving and that poor people make bad decisions when given money needs to be broken. And we have a major opportunity here in Chicago to prove that out.
And as we think about that narrative that you're talking about, I'm curious about this in the context of, I'm thinking about the farm bill as that's being debated right now and how that conversation is in regards to SNAP benefits or food stamps. And there's a conversation that we need to cut these benefits. Some Republicans argue that that's a disincentive to work, to be giving people more benefits. So what would you say to someone who says that handing out cash is even worse?
What I would say to them is most people who live in poverty, most people who qualify for Medicaid, who receive Medicaid, lots of these folks work full time and yet still can't put food on the table or pay their bills, or they're trapped in a cycle of poverty and debt. So the economy isn't working for them. That is my answer to them. Number two, the idea that, say, for example, people would stop working because of a UBI pilot that provides $500 a month is just nonsense. That's $6,000 a year. No one is leaving a full-time job for $6,000 a year. What this will do is make sure that a family who has a tough time paying their child care or putting diapers on their infant or buying that last week of groceries, that they will be able to do that. And I think there is a case to be made for direct cash rather than always talking about benefits, because I think those benefits are important and they shouldn't go away. But I think on top of that, in the same way that Social Security provides a cash disbursement, universal basic income is also required so that people can make ends meet.
My guest is Chicago Alderman Amaya Pawar. We're talking about a resolution that he's proposed in the Chicago City Council that would call for a pilot program to give $500 a month to 1,000 families. As I mentioned before, this has been tried on a small scale in a couple of cities in California, and Alaska has its own version of this. It's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. Alderman, in Alaska, that fund comes from the billions of dollars in oil revenue. In the case of Chicago, where would you see the money for this pilot project coming from?
So if we impanel this task force, we'll figure out what the size of the cohort is. My instinct is to always go big and go for as big a pilot as possible. We might have to settle on a smaller number. That's fine. The money, we would be seeking out philanthropic support to prove out this point that poor people don't make bad decisions when they have the ability to make decisions about their finances. So we would be seeking philanthropic support. But let me just say this. The federal government, Congress, passed a $1 trillion tax cut. Over a third of the beneficiaries of that $1 trillion tax cut are sovereign wealth funds, meaning foreign countries who make investments in the stock market. So it's not as if those dollars went to average working class Americans. They didn't go into our neighborhoods. Those tax cuts went to foreign nations and their sovereign funds. So we can find the political will and the ability to cut taxes and, in many ways, provide a direct cash disbursement to wealthy sovereign funds, to the 1%, to the very wealthy. But when it comes to helping our neighbors who are struggling to make ends meet, all of a sudden there are questions about, well, what do we do about accountability? Are people going to leave work? To me, that conversation is nonsense, and that narrative needs to be broken.
Alderman, I just wanted to ask you one last question about, this is something you're trying to implement in Chicago. Is this something that you think would also, in your mind, ideally be needed outside of Chicago and throughout the rest of the state of Illinois as well?
I think this is a conversation, modernization of the EITC, universal basic income, has to be a state and national conversation, because I always talk about the automation of long-haul trucking. There are 2 million plus jobs connected to that in supply chain and driving the actual truck, the motels, the repair. All of those industries likely will disappear as Amazon and Tesla and these companies invest billions of dollars in taking those jobs away to drive up profits. So what are we going to do? Are we just going to let people be automated out of the workforce, or are we going to provide a social safety net? And are we going to help people who currently work full time and are struggling to make ends meet? And this is why this conversation, because it's things are only happening in major cities, I think Chicago has the opportunity to lead the national conversation so that we can have this in a more rational and honest way.
That's Democratic Alderman Amaya Pawar. He represents Chicago's 47th Ward on the city's north side. Alderman, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the Alderman's proposal for a universal basic income and how the city of Chicago, he's proposed, could create a pilot program to see how well this works. When we're talking about income inequality, a recent study by the Economic Policy Institute found that on average in Illinois, the top 1% of income earners make 27 times the amount compared to the other 99%. I'm joined now by Bob Bruno. He's a professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the 21st.
It's nice to be back. Thank you.
Bob, we heard Alderman Pawar talking about automation, and I wanted to ask you, as someone who studies the labor industry, how much do you think automation is a really big challenge to a sector of our labor market going forward?
There have been some recent studies done. This is a legitimate concern. We really haven't seen the robots take over yet. And of course, someone's going to have to manufacture the technology. But to think about a universal basic income or a negative income tax as a way to respond to a future that will require fewer people to do work, I think is a legitimate concern and a legitimate response. It has already impacted the manufacturing sector in ways even exceed bad trade deals, but we could expect to see them impacting the service sector and into professional occupations.
Right. So when we're talking about the service sector, for example, the McDonald's example that we talked about earlier, I'm thinking of there's that new McDonald's. Well, it's not the new McDonald's, but it's a McDonald's in downtown Chicago where they have replaced basically all of their clerks with iPads. And there's one cashier now that McDonald's on State Street in Chicago where mm-hmm. you have to kind of walk in. That's the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, it's one of the kinds of things. And of course, we should be really attentive to what's happening in the service sector, because close to 2/3 of all of the jobs that the modern economy is creating is actually happening in the service sector, where wages are actually below the median wage. So that's one. But even in middle-class paying occupations like the construction industry, where we see technology created that can pave a road and to lay brick at such a rate, at a certain level of efficiency, that no longer requires quite the same size of a road crew. We'll see it there. We see it in medical record keeping and in the legal profession in terms of collecting and holding data. So there really is not an industry that's immune from this. But even putting aside what the likely or probable impact of technology and automation is to creating job redundancy, we do have a very large low-wage labor force. And there's a need to address the inability of people to live even reasonably well on wages that are below $15 an hour, that are below $10, $12 an hour, over 60% in the healthcare field, excluding professionals like doctors and nurses, are earning incomes that are below $15 an hour. You've got a quarter of the workforce working for less.
And Bob, when we think about that, right, when you think about how much people are earning and the whole idea of automation, traditionally, when we've thought about how this has happened in the manufacturing sector, the answer has been, let's give people more training. How much do you think a universal basic income, giving people cash, would be another way to solve this? I think oftentimes we've talked more about retraining workers.
Well, it's not a substitute for retraining workers. It's not a substitute for investing in education. What you're doing with a universal basic income is you're providing a wage floor. You're providing some wealth floor that will actually enable people to stay in the labor market, to stay in the job, that will create some incentives for both the individual and the employer to invest in those workers. So this modest amount that the worker would get with a UBI actually enables them to stay within that job, to invest in it, and to take advantage of what would hopefully be additional professional development. Employers would have a greater incentive to put the money into training, for example, because the burden might be off them in terms of constantly having to to increase the annual wage.
So let me ask you one last question then. I think when we talk about, we've been talking this hour about income inequality, we've heard so much of a conversation about automation, and what that looks like, what it's looked like over the past few decades, what that may look like in the future. I think we've always had this idea that in America, that if you work hard and if you get a job, you can support yourself and your family. Do you think that's still viable for most Americans?
Well, the painful truth is that is more myth than reality. That's what's most changed about going to work. There was a time that the best way to ensure prosperity and a middle class life was you'd go to work. There was an investment in that job. Very often those jobs were unionized. There was government protections for those jobs. And as you gained seniority, your quality of life improved. I think it's more of a lie now than a reality that you can, through work, through employment, actually ensure prosperity for you and your family. Too many workers are working below that $15 wage, below the $11 wage. Too many workers are only getting 20 hours, 14 hours, 30 hours a week. Millions of workers don't have adequate health care, and we're simply not creating the kinds of jobs that provide that kind of income security. And we don't have the government institutions. We can't raise the minimum wage at the federal level. Tax policy is really skewed to the wealthy. And of course, there have been attacks on collective bargaining and labor unions. So the idea of the American dream being possible through employment, which should be a strongly conservative principle, not government's assist, not government aid, but employment. All of that, really, I think, is in serious dispute. And something like UBI is a way to make work pay, to once again incentivize people to stay in the labor force and allow people to work their way to prosperity.
That's Bob Bruno. He's a professor. He also directs the labor education program at the University of Illinois. Bob, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Programming is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Limbs, a premiere performance by Chicago-based artist Erica Gressman, September 13th at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you spent any time looking for a new job recently, then you know that technology makes it a lot easier. Perhaps you're an employer looking for new candidates. There are online search tools and networking sites like LinkedIn. You can conduct interviews via Skype. You can use the web to search for tips on everything, on resume templates to how to dress to impress. Technology has also become so sophisticated that many companies are now using artificial intelligence to filter through those resumes, even answer applicant questions. But think about all the controversy surrounding Facebook's algorithm when it comes to determining our news feed. Now, think about using other algorithms to determine who gets a job interview. Alexia Alejalde Ruiz recently reported on this for the Chicago Tribune. She joins us now, along with Jeffrey Blumenfeld, who's on the line with us. He's the director of Career Moves at JVS Chicago. They provide career counseling and exploration services. We've also got Tony Lee with us from the Society for Human Resource Management. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alexia, I wanted to start with you and your story. I mentioned a couple things, LinkedIn, video interviews. Can you tell us some of the other ways that technology and artificial intelligence is being used in hiring?
Yeah, so we're kind of at the start of it. So some of the ways that we're starting to see it are, for example, little chat tools on a company's career site that allow people to apply for jobs using kind of just like natural language, so they don't have to necessarily upload a resume. They can instead, you know, the little chat bot asks them, like, you know, when are you available, for example, if you're applying for a restaurant job? Are you over 18? Stuff like that, so you can kind of have a back and forth with a little robot. And it's supposed to, the idea is that it can understand your language and, you know, ask relevant follow-up questions. And then there are other ways, you know, there for companies that are searching for, like, passive candidates, they'll put put like web crawlers that'll just search all the publicly available information to search for people who might be appropriate for a role, and then they compile kind of a database of potential candidates. And then the other way that I think is one of the more interesting and also one of the more controversial ways is in these hiring algorithms that companies are using, in which they analyze their existing top performers at their work and create an algorithm based on that, and then look for people or evaluate candidates based on that information to find similar people with similar traits, so that they can find the best fit for the company.
I want to get to those hiring algorithms, back to that in a moment, Alexia. But can I first ask you, I was surprised to learn from your story that job applicants are in some cases even video recording themselves answering interview questions. How common is that?
Yeah, so when I spoke with a man, actually, who Jeff at JVS put me in touch with, he was saying that on frequently, like, it's not uncommon for him to have to get on, you know, do an interview with the computer. Basically, so the computer spits automated questions at him, and he has, 2 minutes to think about it, and then he has 40 seconds to answer, or the other way around. And then, you know, the computer spits the next question at him and stuff like that. And so he's being recorded, so they're seeing him, you know, how he speaks and how he responds and everything like that, but he doesn't have anybody else on the other side.
Jeff, as you're working to train people looking for jobs, I wonder how that's changed and how you're helping people navigate this new digital culture.
I think there are a number of factors that are involved that make it extremely helpful and useful for individuals in terms of the speed at which people can access information and the variety of information that's available. But on the downside, there are a number of individuals who find that technology is intimidating, and that can be a very difficult process, especially in terms of some of the means in which you were just discussing that people are accessing an interview process. So, for instance, an individual who would be well-rehearsed and feel comfortable being able to speak to a blank screen and answer questions would have no problem and would probably do very well. There's some individuals who, like myself, I have a very difficult time because I find it really important to pick up on the cues that we get from seeing a person and from interacting with people. So it's a real mixed bag at this point in time.
And I wonder, Tony, if you can weigh in here from SHRM's perspective, the Society of Human Resource Management, why are companies using tools like this? Is it just to make the process a little bit more cost efficient as well as efficient overall?
Well, it's not necessarily cost efficient. It's more reacting to an incredible talent shortage that's going on, you know, nationwide and beyond. Companies are struggling to fill a number of positions from hourly to the executive suite. And just to try and keep up with that demand, HR is doing everything it can to identify qualified candidates and then get through the process of having them interviewed and approved and hired as quickly as possible. Every empty position that's not filled costs companies money. And so they're very motivated to try and find the best fits and get them in place as quickly as possible. So as a result, you'll see companies adopt the technologies that we're talking about to try and speed the process. I mean, Amazon's a great example of one that's leading the way in terms of a number of their positions. Candidates are offered jobs before they've ever met anyone in person. They have tests that they can take online to prove their skills in a certain area. A lot of it's IT, but others as well. And if they score to a certain level, the next message they see on their screen is, congratulations, would you like to come work for us? So, you know, companies need to do what they can in this environment to try and identify and hire folks as quickly and efficiently as they can.
Alexia, as Tony is describing this, I wonder, I immediately just think, are there legal issues with doing that? Or what other pitfalls did you find in your reporting from this digitization of the job process?
Right. So a risk in creating the algorithms, for example, is that the training set that you use to train the algorithm, meaning the original employee sample, you know, whether that has bias baked into it. So, for example, if you have Because, like, so the big concern, you know, in the hiring process is that humans are, you know, inherently can have biases. They prefer people who have gone to their alma mater, or they just have a certain idea of what somebody should look like when there's role, and it's not blatantly, you know, trying to be discriminatory, but there it is. And so the idea is that if you're training an algorithm based on the people who have been promoted in the past, who have gotten raises in the past, who are, you know, doing well at a job for one reason or another, then that could bake in certain qualities that could potentially set you up for violating an anti-discrimination law, because algorithms look for patterns, you know, so they just might take a whole lot of information and kind of create this like idea of, but I'm not a technology person, so I'm not going to use the right words, but, you know, they look for patterns, and the potential risk is that it could screen people out based on whether it's race or age or, you know, other or disability or other things that are protected by anti-discrimination laws, and that could potentially put employers at risk, although granted it's always very hard to prove that.
Tony, do you think lots of employers, I imagine even huge employers like Amazon, certainly are considering those legal ramifications as well as they're thinking about these algorithms or these tests?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things to think about here. First of all, the testing that's being done are not algorithms that are based on past performance of employees. They're based on future performance on very specific skills. So if you look at the algorithms asking whether or not someone can code in a certain way or can connect the dots in a logistics issue a certain way, they're not based on how others have done it in the past. They're calculations. They're mathematical. So they do their best to remove bias that way. Now, that said, there is no question that implicit bias is a problem and an issue that every company is struggling with to make sure that their hiring managers are, acting on clear and rational and relevant data and not allowing their biases to come in. But I want to share one example of how technology eliminated this bias. Analytics is huge in HR right now, and every HR professional is doing their best to become math experts, even though most of them got into HR because they weren't math experts. But consider the case of a company that had a big college recruiting program, and every year they would go to the same colleges to do the same recruiting, and the colleges they selected were because they were the alma maters of their CEO and their CFO and their other executives. And so they were hiring at colleges where they didn't know if they were the right places to be. They were just going there because that's the bias of senior management. When they applied analytics, they found that their model needed to be flipped on its head, that the kind of elite schools that they had been going to, because that's where their senior executives went, the employees they hired lasted the shortest amount of period with the company and ended up the lowest rated for those who remained. On the other hand, employees they had hired from local community colleges and from other local state schools turned out to be the most loyal, best-performing employees they had. And they found that through using analytics. So it actually removed all biases, and they changed their recruiting process because the analytics showed that they were better off going to schools where that was more diverse and had a wider array of candidates.
We're talking about the technology and digitization of the job process with, that's Tony Lee with the Society for Human Resource Management. Alexia Elejalde Ruiz is also with us. She's a business reporter who first was reporting on this with the Chicago Tribune. Jeffrey Blumenfeld is with us as well, and he works to provide career counseling and exploration services. Jeff, I wanted to come back to you as we were just discussing this whole notion of tests and job processes and doing everything online. There is a certain level of digital savvy that is required with that. And I wonder what you're seeing with the folks that you're working with. If they don't have that level of comfort, are you concerned that they're now left out of a lot of opportunities within the labor market?
I think that you find the biggest disparity in an age group where those individuals have not grown up with technology, so that you are obviously looking at individuals that are probably 50 plus. And even though they have a certain comfort level with technology on a day-to-day basis, the learning curve is a greater learning curve. It's a slower curve for many individuals, although once they are up to speed in terms of whatever technology they're trying to acclimate to, they're absolutely every bit as good in terms of their skill sets as anyone else would be. But there is a different learning curve as a result of not growing up with technology and it not being something that they're as easily comfortable with as a younger group. So you do find that older individuals shy away from many of the means in which people could access employment as a result of their hesitancy to become involved with technology. And it's a real challenge for older workers to be able to move into certain spots in employment that are open to them, but because of their comfort level, it doesn't exist.
I wonder, Jeff, how much this is different, though, than the unfortunate, certainly, but very real age discrimination we've seen in the workplace. By and large, we hear lots of older workers talking about how hard it is for them to get jobs. Is this any different?
I think in some ways it is different because it's a matter of individuals basically confronting the fact that there are younger workers in the workforce that they need to learn to feel comfortable with. And I think most people that are older actually embrace that mixture of young and old in the workplace. There's a lot to be said for that mixture of what older workers bring to the workforce and what younger workers bring. So in that sense, I don't think it becomes as much an issue, but I think in the just purely acclimating technology, I think it is an issue in terms of their being able to, once again, to access jobs in the same way that perhaps younger workers would.
Just one last question for you, Jeff, then. Are you just doing practicing? Like, I wonder when you're working with people with career counseling, is it just a matter of getting them comfortable with this format and operating within this realm?
We spend a lot of time supporting our clients through the process of learning to interview, whether it's online, whether it's in person, whether it's over the phone, whether the phone is a screening or an actual interview. So there are many different ways in which we can support them in that process, and they can learn to certainly become more comfortable not only with the technology, but also with the process. It is a challenge, I would say that, and that it's not for everybody. There are certainly individuals, as I said before, that do shy away from it, and they will gravitate towards jobs that they can get the old-fashioned way by networking, by actually face-to-face interviewing and going through that process. But I would say that obviously those individuals who are open to learning and moving in that direction really reap the benefits of a much broader variety of job opportunities.
That's Jeff Blumenfeld with the Director of Career Moves at JVS Chicago. They provide career counseling and exploration services. I want to thank Tony Lee as well with the Society for Human Resource Management and, of course, the Chicago Tribune's Alexia Elejalde Ruiz for bringing this topic to our attention. Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear from award-winning physicist Vicky Calogera about her research into gravitational waves. Stay with us for this special Labor Day edition of the 21st. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Support for the 21st comes from the University of Illinois Press, publishers of University of Illinois, Engine of Innovation, documenting 175 years of innovation in agriculture, engineering, and the arts at the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Listening to the 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. When two black holes collide, they create ripples in space and time known as gravitational waves. It sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but for a team of researchers led by Vicky Calogera, it's the real thing. Vicky is a professor of physics and astronomy at Northwestern University. She directs its Center for Interdisciplinary Exploration and Research in Physics, and she was awarded the Danny Heinemann Prize for Astrophysics. She's on the line now from Evanston. Vicky, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
And congratulations on the award. For us lay people, can you explain? Is this like the Oscars of physics, the Heinemann Prize?
Oh, I don't know. We don't get to walk on the red carpet.
So this, you work with black holes. And before we get started into what the awards committee said about what you did, I wonder if you can explain for us, what do we know about how black holes actually form?
So what we understand about black holes is that big picture, we know of two types of black holes. Black holes that form from stars, like our sun, except if we want to form a black hole, they have to be more massive. So our sun has a mass of one times the mass of our sun. If we want to get a black hole eventually, we need to have a star that's about 10 times or 20 times the mass of our sun. And when that kind of star completely consumes the nuclear fuel in its center, then it cannot resist its own gravity anymore, and it ends up collapsing. And the gravity wins all together and brings the whole star into a single point. And that at the end, the mass collapsing into a single point, basically forms what we understand to be a black hole, per Einstein's predictions a century ago.
And
go ahead.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask where gravitational waves come in then.
So gravitational waves are also predictions of Einstein's theory from a century ago. And what Einstein understood when he developed his theory of general relativity is that when masses are moving and are being accelerated in space, they can actually disturb space and time, but it's easier to just think of space. And when masses are moving very rapidly, then they can jiggle space and generate waves, and the waves can propagate at the speed of light, the same way light, regular electromagnetic waves, light that our eyes can see, propagate. Now, when black holes are forming in this collapse, then gravitational waves can be generated because the formation is very violent and matter collapses at very high speed. But at the same time, there is another way of generating gravitational waves. If you manage to get two black holes that have already formed, but then the black holes are can find themselves in orbit one around the other, just like the Earth is going around the sun, if you imagine now two black holes going one around the other, the two black holes eventually can come closer and closer to one another. If they collide, then they are disturbing the space-time extremely intensely, and they generate gravitational waves.
So what is it?
These waves that we have observed.
Okay. What does it mean, though, to disturb space and time?
So
is that too complex to explain?
It is.
A little bit.
But it's easy. It's easy to understand if we think about it in the following way. So think of an undisturbed lake that is very flat. The surface of the lake is very flat and undisturbed. If we throw a stone onto that lake, then, of course, the surface of the lake is disturbed, right? The stone falls in, it goes into the bottom of the lake, and then ripples at the surface of the lake are being created as circles, and they propagate propagate at the surface. So when two black holes are moving one around the other, when the collision happens between the two black holes, then the biggest disturbance occurring in space-time, just like at the moment of the stone touching the surface of the lake, you get the biggest disturbance. And the gravitational waves are exactly causing a similar disturbance. The space at the moment of the collision is being disturbed in a very similar way as the surface of the lake. So you get these ripples, but now the ripples are not happening on the surface of the lake. They're happening actually in space. So space is being stretched and squeezed just like the surface of the lake in my example.
Vicki, how did you first become interested in all of this? How did you end up studying astrophysics?
So you may notice I have a subtle accent in my speaking, and I grew up in Greece, and I liked math as a student in high school, and I decided eventually I discovered physics in high school, and I pursued physics in my undergraduate studies. While as a college student in Greece, I discovered astronomy by taking a course, and I came across readings about compact objects like black holes, and I learned about what they are and what we understood at the time, and I got exposed through, again, courses and readings to the possibility of doing research on black holes as an undergraduate student already. And I decided that this was something I could not resist. I had an opportunity to pursue research outside of Greece, and eventually I came to the U.S. to do my graduate studies. And I can't explain why exactly I wanted to do this, but I really, it was like falling in love. And since then, I've been studying black holes, and eventually I've had the opportunity to live through this amazing discovery of gravitational waves that for a century since Einstein's prediction, we've been trying to detect, and we finally, through a big collaboration of people, we managed to achieve.
I want to ask you about that, because I know we spoke with two members of your team about this last summer. But first, I just wanted to go back to your education for a minute, because I read that your mother didn't receive more than an elementary school education because her dad didn't think that girls should be educated. But your father was kind of the opposite of that, wasn't he?
Yes, actually, I'm not sure where you found it, but it is true. So my parents grew up through the Second World War in Greece, and then we had the Civil War. So they didn't have the opportunity to go through higher education. My mother was told by her father that elementary school education was perfectly enough for girls. And so after elementary school, she was told that even high school was too much. And she was then, you know, absorbed in high school household activities, etc. My father finished high school, top of his high school, always wanted to pursue math, but instead he needed to basically support the family after the war, and he went into finding a job and earning resources for the family. When I was a girl, even though my father was extremely conservative, when it came to education, he was convinced that education meant opportunities for a better life. And he was very conservative when it came to my upbringing. He had definitely different behavior for me compared to my older brother. But for education, it was definitely something that he thought should be equal between boys and girls. And he never stopped encouraging me. I liked math, and he thought it was perfectly fine for a girl to pursue a math and physics career. And that certainly had an impact on me.
Well, because I imagine when you were first starting out in the field, there were probably not very many other women who were studying astrophysics.
No, I didn't know of any woman who studied astrophysics. I went into undergraduate studies in Greece, and all my professors were male. And the funny thing, in retrospect, I must admit, is that it didn't even impress me at the time. It was all so normal that all the professors were guys. I wasn't even conscious of it because this was the environment. And yet it didn't occur to me that maybe this was not for me. It didn't stop me or gave me pause. So there was something very attractive about astrophysics.
Well, and I imagine now, as we're speaking with Vicky Calogero, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at Northwestern University, for your students, are you seeing a lot more women in your classrooms?
Yes, we definitely have a lot more women in the classrooms, but more importantly, we have a lot more women in professor positions. Challenges, of course, continue to exist. At Northwestern, I have been very fortunate. I've loved my career. The university have enabled for me to advance. I pursued all the opportunities I wanted to pursue. But even with all the support, the reality remains. I have been at Northwestern for, 17 years. And the next female astrophysicist after me was hired 1 year ago. So that tells you something about, not about Northwestern or specifically our group, but it just tells you something about the overall community of science and astrophysics and how difficult it is. So there's a long way ahead of us. We keep improving, but we're not there yet.
Can I get back to the science for a minute, into the gravitational waves you mentioned, because this was a huge discovery that happened just for the third time ever. And we spoke with two of the members of your team about LIGO, that's the instrument that's being used to help detect these gravitational waves. What have you learned so far about the gravitational waves that were detected?
Yes, so a number of very exciting things. So first of all, the ability to detect gravitational waves is a whole new way of doing astronomy. So all of astronomy for four centuries since Galileo has been based on detecting electromagnetic waves. And this is regular light that our eyes can see, and all the other types of waves we often hear about, X-rays and gamma rays and microwaves and infrared, that detectors that were developed for astronomy are now being used for all kinds of applications in our everyday life, from medicine to defense purposes, microwaves in our kitchens, etc. Gravitational waves is another type of messenger that is being delivered by astrophysics cosmic sources that we knew existed, but we had no way of detecting. So just the ability of detecting it is equivalent to the first time of Galileo turning his telescope and observing Jupiter for the first time. So we're opening a new way of doing astronomy and studying the cosmos. So we're very excited about just this amazing new capability, because we know we're going to discover new things that we haven't imagined in the same way that has happened for electromagnetic astronomy. With a few discoveries we have achieved just in the past couple of years, with this new instrument, LIGO, we have already found out that black holes, a lot more massive than we ever knew, exist. We call them heavy black holes. They are 30 and 40 times the mass of our sun. It's a bit of a puzzle for how exactly they form. Questions of formation is exactly what I study. There were some hints in computer simulations that maybe there is a way of forming them. And the fact that we have now found them in gravitational waves and had not seen them in electromagnetic waves was a bit of a surprise. And we're trying to understand through gravitational waves how this happens in nature.
Wow. So thank you so much for explaining that to us. And I will look forward to hearing more about the research that all of you, that astrophysicists across the country, but in particular in Evanston and at Northwestern University, are working on. Vicky Calogero, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on past shows, how to follow us on Facebook or Twitter. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email. Just head to 21stshow.org. We're produced by Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.